When University of Wisconsin President Charles Van Hise insisted that Eugene Looning teach counterpoint, Looning replied that the students weren't ready for it. But Van Hise insisted. Harvard offers counterpoint, he said. Yale offers counterpoint. The University of Wisconsin must offer a counterpoint. So Looning obliged. But the highest grade he gave was a 48. When Van Hise called him to task for it, Looning replied, I was being generous. Bach gets 100. I myself don't get more than a 75. Counterpoint, that overlay of two or more musical parts or voices to form a coherent texture, has been a key component of classical music for hundreds of years. Where did it come from, and why has it endured so long? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What makes counterpoint so difficult for composers to master? What became of it after it reached its high water mark in the works of Bach? And do composers still use counterpoint today? Our guest is Lee Blasius, composer and professor of music theory at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Well, thank you for having me.
Most of us have heard the point-counterpoint on 60 Minutes or other places where it's just a debate, a point, mm-hmm. and a counterpoint. But let's get a good definition. Norman mentioned a little bit about it, but let's get a real good working definition of counterpoint before we go back and talk about where it came from.
Well, the definition is rather simple. It's writing one note against another, having two of them sound simultaneously, and there are certain rules that govern the progression of that.
But not all music is counterpoint, so do you have to have independent melodies that are operating at the same time?
How does it vary from harmony?
To a certain degree, you have independent melodies that work, but most theorists today would argue that music through about the 1840s or 1850s is governed by counterpoint, that underneath Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, Mendelssohn, Brahms, that there's a contrapuntal framework that governs everything, and that harmony itself is kind of a surface phenomena that arises out of counterpoint.
And from what does counterpoint arise? Or do we find it in the Middle Ages?
Counterpoint starts probably about the 8th, 9th century, where, imagine it this way, you have your cathedral chapter, your choir, which is singing their body of chant, and you have a couple of really good singers who are rather bored by this. Naturally, they want to go and they want to elaborate on it, which is a sort of both political and moral problem there. But what we do find is very early on, singers are singing one voice against another rather than all singing on the same voice. So what happens is fairly early on, you get people trying to figure out how do you govern this sort of one voice against another. And they draw on classical music theory from the Greeks, where there are certain intervals that are consonant, which sound good together, and then some intervals which are dissonant together, and start coming up with a series of rules. So what you get is a sort of emergent system that comes out of this that gets ever more elaborate.
So is passing dissonance acceptable in this scheme of things?
Yeah, a passing tone would be, well, the way that one teaches counterpoint, the classical way, is through what we call species, where you take a melody, very simple melody, maybe a fragment of chant, Re, fa, mi, re, so, fa, la, so, fa, mi, re. And you do this in equal values. Then over top of it or below it, you write a separate melody. And in first species, the way we would teach it is each interval has to be consonant with the pre-existing melody. But the new melody has to be a melody on its own. So against that, I could sing La, la, so, fa, mi, re, oof, mi, re, mi, fa. If I sang those two together, they would sound in harmony.
One of the kinds of counterpoint that most of us would know about would be the round, right?
Round is a canon, yeah.
Round or canon, I mean, mm-hmm. that it becomes counterpoint the moment that the two melodies start working. I mean, in that case, it's one melody that if you sing around, does it become counterpoint?
It becomes counterpoint, and that was one of the traditional one of the games that composers like to play, and one of the traditional ways of teaching is you wrote canons. So a round would be a canon where you sang it at the same pitch level, but you can write canons, as of course Bach is going to do, which start a fifth higher, a fifth lower, or start some other place. You can write canons where one voice is at half the tempo of another or two-thirds of the tempo of another. It gets to be a rather complicated and fun game. You can write a canon where the voices, one voice starts at the beginning, one starts at the other end, and they sort of backtrack on each other.
Oh, so they're inverse.
Yeah, kind of concrescence, yeah.
I think I've played table duets where one person stands on the opposite side and somehow it all works out upside down on the music.
Yes, and you meet in the middle. That would be another sort of canon.
So there's an element of the puzzle, it seems to me, the kind of almost like you mentioned it, like a game, but it
composers like puzzles, and counterpoint is from its very beginning is a sort of puzzle of working out what things will work within fairly restricted number of rules.
That's where that term canon comes from, as in canon law.
Yeah, canon is a rule, and what you would get would be oftentimes there were puzzle canons where you would get a line of music, and then you would get sort of a puzzle which would give you a clue as how to construct the canon, but they wouldn't make it obvious.
Is there an early example we can listen to of counterpoint?
Yeah, perhaps one of the counterpoint is going for a while through the Middle Ages, but where it really comes to flourish is getting on into the Renaissance. One of the more interesting figures was a man named Johannes Tinctorius, who was one of my predecessors as a theorist. Rather a dull one, actually. The problem with counterpoint is working with two voices is fairly easy. When you start putting a third voice, it gets more complex. And it's hard to find what the rules are to specify them exactly. Tinctorius tried to figure this out, so he wrote a theory book, which is large sets of tables of if we have three voices in this configuration on these notes, then you can go to here. But he was also a composer, so maybe we should listen to some Tinctorius.
Members of the Early Music Consort of London with an excerpt from the Missa Sine Nomine, a Mass Without a Name, that was the Kyrie, by Johannes Tinctorius, sort of a cautious approach, as you suggested, Lee, to counterpoint there.
Well, he doesn't make any mistakes in there, but it's interesting what you can hear in in the tinctorius is that the voices are equalized. Each one has a melody. He tends to start each section with a sort of canon, what we call a point of imitation. The ends of the phrases sound in many ways very modern, sort of harmonic at the end. And that's simply, it's something that grows out of the counterpoint. With two voices, you have a formula for ending phrases. And when you add a third voice, particularly underneath, there only is really one way to do it, which turns into our modern cadence.
And I guess, you know, just to clarify the difference between what we just heard and, say, a barbershop quartet, the barbershop quartet would not be counterpoint because the four men in that case would be more or less singing in unison. They would be singing harmony,
yeah.
You know, taking a melody and all,
yes,
kind of creating chords with it, but not working like four independent agents.
No, in something like barbershop harmony, what you're going to get is you have different roles and subordinate voices. So it's a much different thing than working with counterpoint.
I'm wondering a little bit about how some instruments, not voices, I suppose, but maybe certain wind instruments, would you not get some kind of strange harmonic relationships when you get into counterpoint? Some overtones that would start to come in?
Well, counterpoint as a discipline is, at first, it's vocal, for vocal music. And that remains the ideal through until the beginning of the 17th century. Once you get instruments involved, instrumentalists like to embellish things. Singers do also. So the system loosens up to accommodate different embellishments and different sort of things that instruments can do.
So how many parts would you get into if you start to talk about instruments? How many parts could you carry counterpoint through?
How do I put it? Think of it again. If we add a third voice to two voices, it gets more complicated. Now, in the Renaissance, somebody like Tinctorius or the like, they aren't writing in score. They'll write one line and then they'll make up a counterpoint on that, and then they'll think of a third one, or they'll hold these in their heads. They had phenomenal melodies. As you keep adding additional voices, the Tinctorius was three, it becomes more and more complicated to hold all these together. The genius of the High Renaissance, somebody like Palestrina, for example, is that they're working with five and six voice textures, oftentimes breaking them down into smaller groups. What happens is that after that, you start with, particularly in the 17th century, with instrumental music coming into the picture, is the texture sort of devolves on either two voices or three voices, but with instruments suggesting voices in between those. So there's an element of not having to have all the voices there playing all the time in order to get the sense of a much richer texture. If you're accompanying somebody on the lute, for example, you know, you would have inner pitches that you would suggest inner voices, something like that. So I'm not sure the number of instruments. There are vocal pieces for 70 or 80 singers that are counterpoint.
That sounds very complex. You mentioned Palestrina.
Mm-hmm.
As we listen to an example from Palestrina, can you tell us what we will hear that we did not hear perhaps in the Tinctorius?
With Palestrina, and Palestrina is writing perhaps 40, 50 years after Tinctorius, and he's a better composer. I'm not sure how many voices that we have in this example, but usually Palestrina is writing a five or a six voice texture. Oftentimes he pays much more attention to the text than does some of the earlier composers.
That was kind of his charge from the Pope, as I recall.
Yes, there is the old
importance.
Story about how Palestrina saved polyphony,
right, right,
for the Catholic Church by writing the Pope Marcellus Mass. In reality, as a good Renaissance scholar, he had good Latin, and he was really concerned with prosody in a way that earlier composers hadn't been, or composers from earlier times. So he tends to treat the words very rhetorically. He's very careful that the melodic shape and the rhythm will match what is going on in the text, so that his Latin, let's put it that way, is much better than some of the earlier composers.
Palestrina. So how many parts or voices there?
Sounded like five voices to me. It might have been six. But this is one of the interesting things with the great composers of the Renaissance is that they're always conjuring up this notion of even more voices being there, oftentimes by having sort of repetition of motives or the like. What they're aspiring to is a sense of harmony in terms of something larger.
It has that effect. It just seems sort of angelic or something, I think. You know.
Yeah, and vocal counterpoint, when it's done right, is you're never sure how many voices there are.
When we return, we're going to listen to the master of counterpoint, Bach. Back in a moment with more University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Lee Iglesias, who's filling us in about one of the cornerstones of classical music, counterpoint, this opposition of voices that somehow weaves gracefully into a greater texture. And we've gotten to the master of them all, I think probably the man whose name is most synonymous with counterpoint is Johann Sebastian Bach. Is he really head and shoulders above those who came before?
Oh, he's pretty good.
He got 100 on that.
Quite good. Well, he's a product of his time. Bach is always somewhat like, if you go to one of those wonderful Baroque churches in southern Germany or Austria or even Rome where, you know, they're full of ornament, but the whole thing is sort of pulled together. There are almost these forces that keep everything in motion, where oftentimes, you know, the architecture of the building itself somehow fades into how the ceiling is painted, so you see pilasters and the like continuing up. Bach always strikes me that way, that he uses counterpoint, but it's always, he's the master of the art of illusion, of making you hear much more than is actually there.
I suppose if counterpoint works right, you just listen to the music and aren't as aware of the undergirdings and the the labor of it, you know.
Well, the counterpoint becomes, in its own way, sort of the undergirdings. There will be a simple counterpoint, and then it'll be will be sort of filled out with more of a surface layer of counterpoint and the like. There are layers on layers on layers in here. And he was sort of the master at controlling the continuities and the trajectories of things and played a lot of games with himself.
One of the most humbling exercises I ever was asked to do in a music theory class was to write a fugue in the style of Bach, where you start with a melody and then, and after, I don't know, just a half a page of music, it was so difficult to keep it up once about the third line came in. You sort of realize how incredible the texture is in any Bach invention or fugue. Can you say something about what a fugue is, what an invention, what these different things that Bach did with counterpoint are?
Well, fugue is basically an instrumental translation of something like we heard with the tinctorus, that a fugue starts with a point of imitation. You have a voice that gives a theme, and then a second voice will come in with the theme, the first voice being in counterpoint with that. And then perhaps a third voice, perhaps a fourth voice doing the same thing. And what you hear is that every once in a while in the fugue, you'll hear this theme or this subject popping out in one voice or another. Oftentimes it will elaborate on itself as you go through. Invention is sort of a generic term. It's a piece. It's something clever. And Bach is certainly clever. The one difference between Bach writing and certainly, say, somebody like Palestrina is, we tend to forget, is that by the time Bach is writing, you're writing in score. So you have instruments on the page which are superimposed on each other rather than just writing a single line and then another line and yet another line. So the size of pieces can increase and the complexity of what they do can increase.
And he's using counterpoint also in, say, the cantatas, fairly complex vocal scores.
Sometimes, yeah, it can be. There's a trick to being complicated at times, to being complicated and making it seem like you're not complicated, and sometimes to be very simple.
Can you set up a Bach piece that we might listen to? Tell us what to hear.
Why don't we listen to the piece that we came in on, which is the B minor French suite, the third French suite, the opening movement. What you're going to hear is there's a lot of imitation here, a lot of canon going on. Sometimes the lower voice will sort of drop out or will sort of just proceed very evenly supporting the upper voice, which recalls what we call the basso continuo, which was a feature, sort of the bass line that always supported Baroque music. But more often than not, it'll join in. Bach plays here with a lot of the same motive. Ba-da-da-dum, ba-da-da-da-da-dum. The thing is that we're only listening to two voices, except at the very end of sections, which you'll hear. But it sounds like many more voices if you listen closely. It sounds like an entire choir.
From the French Suite, number 3 of Bach.
Thank you.
it does sound like a whole choir there after a while.
Well, particularly it thickens up towards the end, but that section that we just heard in the second section is, it's all a series of canons, one voice imitating the other, and then they sort of change positions and go through. And this is what Bach likes to conjure up.
What I notice, too, is what a sense of peace there is at the end. You know, because you've listened to these opposing voices and sort of almost as if you're watching two people that are about to crash, but they never do. But at those final chords, there is a real sense of rest and peace. I think.
There's always a sense, or of you've sort of, it accumulates as it goes along and you finally get to the end where it can settle.
I was trying to think of the appeal of counterpoint besides the sort of game, the puzzle, the, you know, sort of the human appeal of it. Do you think it's something about managing opposing voices, trying to bring together disparate elements into a whole?
There's a theatrical element to it. Certainly that's a large part of it, that this is, it's that sort of sense of managing things and bringing them.
Almost like juggling balls or something.
Like juggling balls, but also like conjuring up different voices and sort of getting this babble of voices, which gradually takes on sort of order.
Seems to me that some instruments, that was Trevor Stevenson on the harpsichord, by the way, but it seems to me that some instruments would lend themselves more easily to counterpoint than others. I mean, could you play counterpoint on a guitar?
Well, I think guitar players had no choice. They had to because certainly most of the music that we're having around this time is there's at least an element of counterpoint to it, perhaps more awkwardly on the guitar.
But the harpsichord where you have those sometimes the double keyboards.
Sometimes with the double keyboards you can do that.
Certainly
the organ is something which lends itself to that.
But a single instrument, I mean, what would you say, a single note at a time instrument? I don't know, something like a recorder,
for
example? Would it be impossible or possible?
No, because what you would get in somebody like, in some Baroque music, think of Bach, the solo partitas for cello or for violin. These are very much composites. They're always, almost always, two or three, sometimes four different lines running, and the instrument just touches on these different lines to keep them alive. So if the instrument is nimble enough, certainly you can conjure up the illusion of a contrapuntal texture.
With something like Handel's Messiah, how does counterpoint fit in there?
At the big moments, certainly, again, it takes on a sort of dramatic function with a chorus. At the big moments, what you want to have is a stretto. And he shall reign forever and ever, and he shall reign, and he shall reign, so on, so on, to get them sort of all of them in the scrum at it, going at this same thing. So oftentimes in choral music, traditionally, you would save the big contrapuntal moment for sort of the high point.
As if to emphasize that everybody is part of it?
Yes, everyone is involved in it, yes.
All those disparate voices. It's maybe a little surprising that as Baroque music became considered old-fashioned, even by Bach's own children, that counterpoint nonetheless survived into the late 18th and early 19th centuries.
Part of what happened was that it was in perhaps the most successful theory treatise or text of all time was by a guy named Fuchs.
J.J. Fuchs.
Yes, J.J. Fuchs, who has wrote a book called Gradus ad Parnassum, which this was, I believe, 1739 or something, which was a text on how you wrote counterpoint through the species, where it's set in the form of a dialogue between a student and a teacher, and the teacher gives the rules and example, and then the student writes his own, and then there are mistakes, and the teacher corrects him. Fuchs's examples are really kind of wooden. But this became very successful. It was translated into every European language very quickly, and it became the general pedagogic text that somebody like Mozart would have learned from, Haydn, any composer through until the early 19th century. You also had, at the same time, coming out of Naples, there was what they called partimenti. And a partimenti was a way of learning to compose where you would just be given a bass line and you had to write one or usually two voices over top of that. So it was automatically contrapuntal. And this was the way you taught composers. We, interestingly enough, have some students of Mozart, particularly an English singer named Thomas Atwood, who Mozart gave composition lessons to. So we got to see a bit of how he taught. There's some species in there, but oftentimes what he was teaching is he would give Atwood a bass line and an upper voice line, and he would have Atwood compose a middle voice. Now, there's quite a trick to this because oftentimes in not-so-good composers, middle voices tend to be very dull. They're just filling in harmonies. And Mozart wants anything but dull. He wants it to come alive. So what you'll see is Atwood will dutifully compose a middle voice, and then Mozart will come along and write something which is just wonderfully vivid in there. But Mozart was certainly a fan of Bach. The Well-Tempered Clavier became a kind of cult classic among composers. He did write fugues of his own, but he liked the game of it, and he certainly incorporated that into his style of composing.
Even in a sonata, for example, one of his piano sonatas.
Yeah, if, for example, the B-flat sonata, I guess Kerschel 533, it's very much in Mozart's style, a sort of opera buffa style, very light, but it's just saturated with little contrapuntal games. So he starts out with a theme, and then the theme gets a little bit of an accompaniment. When we hear it the next time, the theme comes in the left hand with the accompaniment over top. He's doing something that we call invertible counterpoint, where you write one line and then a second line below it, but you can always flip them over and they'll still sound good. So he plays games with invertible counterpoint in here. The same thing keeps coming back in upper and lower voices. He has sort of a mock fugue in part of this, or mock stretto. Wonderful piece in terms of a primer on how you write counterpoint.
This is Alfred Brendel with the beginning of Mozart's piano sonata, Kerschel 533.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's Mozart, Piano Sonata, Kochel 533. Did counterpoint survive into the 20th century? We'll look at that in a moment when we continue with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Lee Blasius, and we are talking about the musical phenomenon, counterpoint. We've heard Bach, we've heard Palestrina, we've heard Mozart, and we get the sense of these melodies that are woven together, independent melodies, but when we hear them together, they have this beautiful harmony because they're following certain rules. What happens when you move out of the classical period and into the Romantic era? Do you have people getting rid of this whole rule-based counterpoint?
It takes on a different valence, counterpoint there. It becomes more of a style or a texture than a way of composing. Part of what happens is that when you have the first conservatories around 1805, the French were the first, they're looking for much more efficient ways of teaching musicians. So in some sense, they dumb down the theory curriculum. They save counterpoint for the real smart students rather than for musicians in general. And this becomes sort of the pattern that it's not something you teach your general musicians anymore, but only those who would be composers. And counterpoint takes on a sort of moral value for the Romantics, that it stands for some sort of integrity and the like. This is the era that Bach first becomes the great hero.
Rediscovered.
Yeah, it's with Forkel in 1795, I think, writing a biography. But they start looking to Bach as a great figure, as certainly the generation after Bach didn't. He was kind of old-fashioned. Even later on, Palestrina, the whole myth of Palestrina, he becomes one of the great figures fairly closely on. In the 1840s, 1850s, you start getting biographies of Palestrina and the like.
Later, Debussy was quite taken with Palestrina.
Yeah, and that was part of the general thing. But counterpoint became something, one, it was supposed to be really difficult, and it had this sort of moral obtuseness to it. So, Beethoven, late in his career, takes up writing fugues, and he's very earnest about it, and they're very difficult, as in the Große Fuge.
Yeah, it's a string quartet movement that's about a quarter of an hour in its own right and quite opaque by some standards.
Very opaque, but it's supposed to be opaque. It's obvious that Beethoven looked at every theory book on how you wrote a fugue, and he was going to do it right. And so counterpoint did take on this sort of valence of being very difficult and at the same time being somehow moral as opposed to, more accommodating music.
Does it take on a nationalistic element? In other words, does it become connected with some countries more than others?
Oh, perhaps the Germans take it most seriously, but they always took everything most seriously. Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure if I would say in particular. Certainly in the French Conservatory, in the counterpoint classes, they cultivated this genre called school fugue, and they were very serious about it. But yeah, it was with the Germans in particular that it had this strange sort of tinge to it.
Mendelssohn, I think, did he not use counterpoint in some of his symphonies, for example?
Oh, quite often, yes. He had a real facility with it, certainly. Brahms is a master of counterpoint, and Brahms would sit down and he would do counterpoint as a way of warming up to compose, and he actually apparently kept a book that he called Octaven and Quinten, which was looking for places in Beethoven and the like, or in Bach, that seemed to violate counterpoint rules, but then he would figure out why it didn't.
Uh-huh.
and the like. All the way through, Arnold Schoenberg was a counterpoint teacher. He, particularly after he came to the United States in the 1930s and was teaching at UCLA, you know, he was trying to drum counterpoint into the heads of his laid-back
students. Sophisticated, backwards over forwards kind of counterpoint.
Well, yeah, he was very much, again, he was sort of inculcated in this world of sort of high counterpoint, and counterpoint as having a sort of moral value, and certainly his 12-tone technique comes out of writing counterpoint, but he was concerned with old-fashioned counterpoint also.
But he also looks at, you know, sort of almost celebrating dissonance in a different way, right? In other words, rather than avoiding dissonance, sometimes that becomes, for 20th century composers, something to almost savor.
That becomes something to savor. Well, through the 19th century, you have this great expansion of sort of the tonal vocabulary of what sort of harmonies they have. And with this sort of expansion goes a lot of anxieties. So you have theorists writing about how music is degenerating. It became a big theme in the 19th century that music was falling apart, that it was all sort of superficial affect and the like. And counterpoint was always looked on as what would save music. And so for Schoenberg, who comes out of this tradition of very chromatic harmony and the like, and for whom seems to reach a limit of what you can do beyond the bounds of sort of traditional music, he looks to counterpoint to save that. So when he comes up with his 12-tone system, it's a contrapuntal system. And it's also, as he puts it, it's a pedagogic system. It's a way of learning to write again and opening up your ears to new sorts of counterpoint.
Well, speaking of harmonic innovations in the 19th century, a composer that I would not have associated with counterpoint in practical terms or, you know, in terms of things he was actually composing would be Wagner.
Wagner is a funny case. As Nietzsche says, he says that Wagner is not a musician, but he's an actor. He always thought of Wagner as somebody who played at being a composer.
They didn't get along, though. Wagner didn't like Nietzsche's compositions.
Oh, Nietzsche's compositions were very bad. But, well, it's interesting. Wagner himself at one point proposes to the King of Bavaria that they need a new conservatory because the standards of performance have fallen down, writes a very detailed memo as to how this should be run and everything else. But when it comes to composers, should you teach composers, he says, no, they should go study counterpoint with the village organists. But what we see in Wagner is it doesn't sound like contrapuntal music, but oftentimes he is playing games with sort of little inversional counterpoints and the like. One passage in particular that sort of stumped the theorists for many years was the very famous opening, the Vorspiel to Tristan und Isolde. For many years, this was sort of, this stumped the theorist. Was this in a key or what the famous Tristan chord?
Yes.
What exactly was it? But 40 years ago, somebody came along and they said, well, look, if you take that opening to Tristan, ba-dum, bum, take the first note up, ba-dum, bum, bum, bum. Follow that line. Now you can find another line. Bum, bum, ba-da-dum, ba-dum. What it really is a sort of invertible counterpoint or counterpoint working out in a wedge, which is very chromatic. And if you look further on, there are all these sort of symmetrical structures in there that sort of one thing will flip over into another. And it's pretty obvious that for at least some of Wagner's harmonic innovations, this notion of some sort of symmetry around an axis is what's driving what sounds very new, very fresh. There's actually a whole branch of music theory called Neo-Riemannian theory out there, which deals with these sort of symmetrical properties that you can generate out of the chromatic system and generating these harmonies. So a lot of the innovation there was born out of a sort of idea of counterpoint that was buried underneath the music.
And so this is counterpoint pretty well concealed by the time we get to Wagner.
But most counterpoint is concealed, yes, but concealed in a different way.
Are there any exciting things happening in composition right now? You know, new compositions, composers working today where counterpoint, even though it goes back in time so far.
That's a tough one. And my easy answer to that, or it's not an easy answer, is that certainly the people I know who teach composition complain that their students don't know counterpoint, that most music today tends to be sort of monophonic. It's one idea and then another and then another. We still require undergraduates taking a composition degree to take a counterpoint class. But that sort of art of writing one line against another has in many ways faded. I'm not a Luddite, so I assume mm-hmm. that other things interesting will happen.
But after
to compensate for that.
What, 1,000 years of counterpoint being fairly prevalent?
Yeah, sort of governing music, yes. We're in a different age.
I suspect, though, that just as with the example from Wagner, that there's probably a lot of music that we listen to and there's counterpoint going on and we simply don't notice it. Are there other sort of famous pieces, the way, you know, we talked about Handel's Messiah, are there other pieces that people might run into quite often in a concert program where if you know to listen for it, you would hear those voices working against each other?
This is where I wish I had a piano. Actually, oftentimes most of Mozart, most of Haydn, awful lot of Beethoven, there is actually sort of a structure of counterpoint underneath that governs things. The thing about counterpoint is that as you teach it and as you learn it, you sort of internalize these little rules and you learn what works stylistically and sort of what doesn't. When I teach a class, I usually find that rules seem very arbitrary to them for about 2 weeks. And then after that, they start being able to pick it up by ear. So they'll hear something in an example that doesn't sound right. And they'll say, wait, that doesn't sound right. And then they'll figure out why it doesn't sound right. So oftentimes, a lot of the music through about the 1830s, if you know counterpoint, you hear all the things that sort of govern it on the surface.
So what do we lose if we don't have counterpoint in classical music to come?
Well, anytime you lose something, you get something else that compensates for it. We live in a very different age for most of classical music. This is music that didn't grow up with recording, for example. And recording has changed how we listen to music. If there is a sort of counterpoint that's going on today or a new practice, it's coming out of the studios and the way we manipulate sounds in the studios.
Overdubbing, for example.
Overdubbing, for example, but just about everything that we listen to is very heavily manipulated and sort of recomposed in the studio anymore. And sooner or later, there will be a theory that comes out of that. I'm sure there already is a sort of informal theory about what you do.
So for you, the joy of counterpoint is what? If you listen to a piece and it's counterpoint done to perfection, what brings you the joy?
It's stylish. Counterpoint's Italian. You know, you go to Italy and you see the carabinieri and they all, you know, their uniforms are perfectly cut and they're all very handsome. And, you know, everybody looks very stylish, at least in parts of Italy. A counterpoint has, there's a sort of panache to it. There's just a style to it of knowing what the rules are and being able to do them correctly.
And it sounds nice.
Yes, exactly.
Our guest this hour has been Lee Blasius. Thanks for filling us in about the wonders of counterpoint. And a pleasure. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.